I'm Elena Lansberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move, the podcast that kicks old stereotypes to the curb. Come meet these creative, outrageous, authentic, adventurous, irreverent, and powerful disruptors and influencers. Grandmothers, from the living room to the courtroom, making powerful contributions in every walk of life. We know them most intimately as loving caregivers, the older women in our lives with a thousand stories about their grandchildren and pictures in their purses. In this podcast, you'll come to know even more about our grandmothers. They are galvanized, determined, and are guaranteed to get you thinking. What drives them? What are they up to? What is the potential of grandmother power, and how is it changing the world? Grandmothers are on the move. You don't want to be left behind. Hi, it's Elena. Welcome back to Grandmothers on the Move. And today I have a great pleasure to welcome Madhu Balanath. Madhu has a long and illustrious history of working in HIV and AIDS, health, reproductive health, sexual rights, women's rights, development, women and political involvement, and women at the grassroots, having started with Swedish SIDA in India, working with UNIFEM as an advisor in India and then Indochina, doing senior policy work, gender and development, and then moving to work on HIV and AIDS with UNDP, the UN Development Program in Asia Pacific, and then with UNIFEM and UNAIDS on gender and HIV as an advisor. She's produced multiple training tools, has worked with International Planned Parenthood as the regional director for South Asia. The list goes on and on. And also the author of four books, one of them, And Then She Stirred, another from Tragedy Towards Hope. Most recently, May I Have Your Attention, Please. Madhu, you've done so much and made such a significant contribution to the world of women's health and gender equality. And I know you've been thinking deeply about these issues for many years. So welcome to Grandmothers on the Move. It's wonderful to speak with you.
Thank you, Elana. You've been so magnanimous in this introduction. Thank you so much.
It's such a deep and wide breadth of work. And I should say right up front that, of course, you inspired me greatly as such a deep thinker, so thoughtful about these issues when I was a young woman starting out in the United Nations, and had a deep influence upon me. And I've carried it with me my entire adult life. You were one of the leaders who was thinking so seriously at all times about the impact of the work at the policy level and the political level around gender equality and women's health and women working at the grassroots in the real lived lives of women. After so many years of doing this work, how do you think about that now?
Yeah, Elana, it's been a very, very interesting journey. And I'd like to give a bit of an introduction. You see, way back as the UN Decade for Women was coming to an end, we were dreaming. We were dreaming because we had been informed and we had learned from the lives of women on the ground. And when we were dreaming, we realized that our dream was not related to sleeping and dreaming. The fact that we were dreaming kept us awake. The fact that we were dreaming ensured that we did not sleep. It was that deep a dream.
Right.
And this really translated the moment we came into UNIFEM. And as you said, I learned so much from you. There was so much energy in UNIFEM that we all supported each other. And the way we hit into pilot projects, advocacy meetings, conferences, writings, we were crying for equality, development, peace. And it was really very, very invigorating for us. The major part of our work was to understand the gender-related fragilities across sectors. You know, what is the whole role of gender, for example, in health, in HIV and AIDS? I mean, the reason why I moved from UNIFEM into UNAIDS was that I saw HIV as a gender issue, period. Nothing else, not as a health issue. So there was all of this to, you know, experience what were the gender-related fragilities across all sectors. Then what we managed to do was we were able to challenge hegemonic thought. You know, the whole stereotype, we used data, statistics, we worked with census officials, we took real life testimonies of men and women, we used experiential techniques that stirred dissonance. And as a result of all this, you know, we celebrated our successes with tears of joy.
Yes.
So I think this is the feeling I'm left with after 3 to 4 decades of work in this area. There was happiness, there was joy, there was energy, there were dreams. And all this was happening when I had a 3-year-old daughter and 11-year-old son who were growing side by side, and I was dreaming and I was joining with sisters across the globe. However, today when I look at myself, I think our successes towards equality have remained peripheral. And that is where I have been thinking through and trying to understand what are those areas and why did equality remain a bit peripheral.
Yes, and it's one of the central reasons why I think it's so important, critical for the way forward for humanity, even though that sounds grandiose, mm-hmm. but in a really serious mm-hmm. way, to speak mm-hmm. to women who have the wealth of experience that mm-hmm. you do, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. these reflections on where did we fall down or what was it that yeah. we missed? What right. did we not tackle so that, you know, 30 right. years on of all of this work, why have we not reached a state of gender mm-hmm. equality? What do you think was yeah. missed and what do you think is needed now?
Right. As you rightly said, it's a huge question, but I will try and synthesize my thoughts as much as I can. I think fundamentally, we did not fully understand what inclusive growth meant. Inclusion was not very much on the agenda. And when I talk of inclusion, I'll raise a few posers, Ilana, which will demonstrate where we missed out on inclusion. Look at the area of sexual and reproductive health. Even today, in many, many countries, the service providers are still sticking to client segmentation, not to client choice of contraception. You know what I mean by this is a service provider will look at you if you go looking for contraception, and he or she will say, oh, so you are 30 years old. You've already had 2 children. One of them is a boy. So the whole issue of son preference is also looked into. So I think now is the time when you should just go in for sterilization. That is the kind of client segmentation that they have in their minds. Client choice just doesn't figure. And I'm talking through first-hand experience on the ground just till about 2017 when all this is happening. And this is in India and many other countries in Asia, at least, that I know of. So that whole concept of trying to include the client into a decision-making process has still not taken ground. Another example I'll give you. In India, there was this fantastic legislation whereby 1.8 million women were brought into grassroots democracy through one ordinance. You know, we have the Panchayati Raj system, and right. 30% of the seats were allocated for women. Fantastic in terms of a legislation. However, we did nothing to work on the institution of that Panchayati Raj. Even today, if I ask anybody in India to close their eyes and picture a panchayat, which is a grassroots legislative body, they will look at 5 men wearing turbans sitting under a tree. Women just don't figure even in the image. So I think the whole institution of Panchayati Raj needed to be overhauled to accept women, to be able to change the image of women into polity. And that I think we have, for example, not been inclusive enough. The numbers are there, but they are more like stamps for men to be able to carry out what they want to do. Another example that I'll give you is the whole issue of using the household as a basic unit for development programs to be channeled through. Now, over the years, once we understood gender, we all started seeing intra-household inequalities. We all realized that the household is not a homogeneous unit. We all knew at that time that there was a lot of exclusion. And I'm using this word inclusion and exclusion because I think these are the two watchwords where we need to now focus. So we were kind of excluding from our minds that the institution of marriage is not empowering enough for large numbers of women in Asia and large parts of the world, frankly. We did not understand fully the concept of multiple deprivations. So at the moment a woman got married, stories ended for children by saying, oh, they were married and they lived happily ever after. And that was it. But the multiple deprivations that a woman is exposed to, how she gets socially excluded the moment she is now supposed to be catering to only the lives of just that one family and the man. So I think there are multiple deprivations that exclude. And I'm grateful to Dr. Amartya Sen, who has brought these out in his theory of multiple deprivations of poverty, where he says that, you know, it's not just economic poverty. There are so many other poverties that are so important to be understood if you really want to track well-being. And I think this is where our focus needs to go now, Ilana. How do you capture well-being? Have you addressed multiple deprivations? So I think really looking at what excludes women. And when I talk of women, I want to expand the definition. We have excluded the LGBTQ community completely. Only last year, Article 377 was abolished from the Indian Constitution, which made homosexuality legal. If you look at the way these countries treat trans men and trans women, it's mind-blowing. I have so many stories.
One of the things that I've learned watching community-based organizations in sub-Saharan Africa work on HIV and AIDS is the struggle to have the kind of insights that come from the intimacy of being involved deeply in the community. Those voices, that understanding is so rarely amplified. It doesn't reach the corridors of power. It doesn't reach many of the UN conversations.
Absolutely.
And I wonder, how do we narrow the gap?
Right. You know, Ilana, one thing that I've been crying out for with the governments, especially the government of India, you know, we examined all their large national program documents. And what we found was there are funds allocated for new messages, but there are no funds allocated for unlearning old messages. Now, that creates this dichotomy that you're talking of, because our policymakers and planners are themselves sticking with the old messages. I'll give you a couple of examples. Way back at the turn of the century, we were working with the truck drivers in India, because at that time, it was felt that it was the truck drivers that were moving the HIV and AIDS epidemic from one place to the other. So there were a number of projects, a huge project funded by four or five donors, in which there were lots of workshops for truck drivers, condom distribution efforts, everything, how to prevent and giving them new learning. So it was so interesting when the project was over after 5 years, there was elation amongst the government officials and they were saying, wow, this has been such a success. So I said, We looked at their indicators, and one indicator of success was number of condoms distributed. Second indicator of success was number of workshops held. Third indicator of success was number of truck drivers who participated in the workshop. And in everything, the project scored high. I went and sat one day at, you know, what we call dhabas. These are roadside cafes where on highways where these truck drivers, as they are plying goods from one place to the other, they stop there, they have their food, they have a bath. And those are the places where some of these workshops were also organized to get them all together. So I sat there one day and there were 27 trucks that came and lined up there because the drivers got out. They went for a bath, relax and whatnot. And there were big buckets full of condoms kept there. They put their hands into it. So I sat there just observing. I was there for about 2.5 days, morning to evening. And one day there were these 27 trucks that arrived. And at that time, some of them, they would open the bonnets of the truck to cool down the trucks. So I potted around. And in 19 of these 29 trucks, I saw condoms around the radiators of the trucks, of the engines.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. So I said, and I sat there. So when they came back, I asked them, brothers in Hindi, Bhaiji, you know, you've attended all these workshops? Yes, we have. And you were told about HIV and AIDS? Yes, we were. What did you learn out of that? Well, we were told that if you use a condom, you will not get HIV and AIDS. I said, good. Then where have you used those condoms? Why are they around these radiators? Oh, sister, this is fantastic. Tested material. When our radiators leak, we use these condoms to stop leakages. And mind you, they're available all over. So now we don't even have to go to a mechanic every time. We just tie these around. I was quite aghast. I said, oh, but weren't they supposed to be used somewhere else? Oh, yes, but. And they were laughing at me. I said, what are you trying to tell me? And they said, you know, when we were being initiated into truck driving, our fathers, our grandfathers, they've all been truck drivers. Nobody got HIV. And when we were being initiated, we were told that every 400 kilometers that you drive, make sure you stop and have sex. If you don't, you will have an accident due to sitting in heated cabins and the heat in your body will not be able to take it. Now look at this. This is what is ingrained in their minds from their fathers and their grandfathers, and is being talked about in the community. And then we say so many workshops held, so many condoms distributed. So this is actually a reality where even our policymakers are living in. And unless we invest in unlearning a lot of these posers that are arising in their day-to-day existence, there will be such a gap. In Senegal, Ilana, when we were working on the female condom and we worked with the leaders of the community, they were all openly supporting the use of the female condoms. But when we interviewed their wives, we realized that these were leaders in form, not in spirit. Those women were not allowed to touch the female condom. So I think this is the reason for the gap, that we have not changed the minds of the people who are supposed to be the change makers. We've not been able to identify the unlearning that is needed. And now I often go and talk to the government departments wherever I can. And I ask them, where is the budget for unlearning? And well, there's not too much of a resistance to this. So I'm hopeful that if projects start including money for unlearning and we identify what has to be unlearned before bringing in the new learning, I think we'll be able to take the lives of our women and their needs into the corridors of power. And they will be acceptable rather than be seen as something on the periphery.
That's really extraordinary. And I think that it says so much about how much learning has to be done by those who are conducting programs and workshops around the world, not just in the developing world, but
everywhere,
around the world.
Everywhere, yeah. And I'll tell you one other thing that's coming to my mind as I speak. Years ago, when I used to work with CEDA, we were called Women in Development Officers, WID officers. You know, gender had not really emerged that time as a concept. And we were running projects all over. And a lot of projects that time were on stitching, weaving for women. You know, it was a very different view of women's development in the late 70s, early 80s. So I realized all my projects on stitching were failing. They were just not going ahead. And I consulted all kinds of books, all kinds of manuals, forward linkages, backward linkages for women's projects, everything to the book I did. But the programs on stitching were just failing. So one day I went and sat, spent about 10 days with the communities where these women were being trained as tailors and were being taught all kinds of stitching and weaving and whatnot. And you know what I learned from the women? Their lived realities are so different. They said, Madhu, none of these projects will succeed unless you give us a truck and a driver. Now tell me, can you see any link between this? And when I explain it to you, you'll see the link. They said, every project on tailoring requires a truck and a driver. They said, in India, the whole ready-made garment industry is being controlled by the truck drivers of West Bengal. Why? Because these truck drivers ply goods from one place to the other. They charge their clients for plying their goods. But what they do in the process is that when they pass Gujarat or Ahmedabad, where all the cloth mills are, they purchase cloth by the kilo. They just buy it at throwaway prices. They bring it free of cost in the trucks. And they bring it to West Bengal near Calcutta, where there is a huge migrant population from Bangladesh, women who are excellent at tailoring. So they get the best skill because they are migrant women. They are willing to work for any amount. And at that time in the early 80s, these women were getting half a rupee. 18 rupees made a dollar that time. So they were getting half of a rupee to make one blouse that goes with our saris. They were getting the cheapest cloth. They got the cheapest labor because they exploited vulnerability. And they managed to sell a blouse for 3 rupees, which was 1/6 of a dollar in the markets. And they flooded the entire country's market because they had these trucks. There were no transportation costs. Now look at this kind of understanding. No policymaker knew about it. And all of the government projects naturally on tailoring and weaving and whatnot didn't fructify. And when we did an analysis, we saw that if 100 women were trained, only 15 to 20 of them managed to earn a very small income from it. These were called income generating projects. About 70 to 75% were those that could only do income saving, which means they stitched their own clothes, which were few and far between. And about 5 to 10% were dropouts. Now you tell me, where is the cost benefit? And these are projects after projects after projects that the government is funding. So the only thing that is needed is to just be with the lives of women. What revealed all this to me was just being there for 10 days, sleeping with them, eating with them, living with them.
This is something that I've heard and learned so much over the years, mm-hmm. that the necessity of understanding the realities of women's lives is not deeply embedded enough in the minds and the approaches. That's right.
Yes.
So let me move us to something else that I really wanted to ask you about. The women's activism in India, it's legendary and it's astonishing. And there's been so much work that's being done around violence against women. There's this incredible movement, and you see it happening at the grassroots, and you see it happening with women who are activists and lobbying government. And yet, the level of violence against women that persists is egregious.
Mind-blowing.
Yes. It's devastating, and it's very high. Right. What are your thoughts when you look at this?
I think, Ilana, the issue of violence against women has to be re-looked at. You know, we looked at the what's very clearly, but we did not look at the how's deep enough. And I think that is where we as activists have to rethink. And I'll sort of again give you an example of a recent news article on violence against women. A minister in the state of Madhya Pradesh from the current government, the BJP government, he was doing mass marriages. You know what they do, some of these ministers, to gain popularity? In their constituencies, they get together a number of poor, rural, poverty-ridden places. They reach there, they pick up the women, and they said, we'll do a mass wedding of 50 girls at a time or 100 girls at a time. And they use their election money for it. It's a way of, I feel, gaining votes also. So there was this thing happening in Madhya Pradesh, and the minister also gives gifts to the brides. So along with a sari and a blouse and a petticoat, he gave wooden bags to these women. And these women were supposed to use those wooden bags. They are normally used to wash clothes. You know, when you're washing clothes with your hand, they sort of hit the clothes with these wooden bags to get all the dirt out. They don't have washing machines there. So he gave them these wooden bags, but on top he wrote, to be used against violence husbands. And he got some 10,000 such bags made and distributed to these women in all the mass weddings that he continued to do. And this is just about a year ago. I was amazed and aghast at the whole understanding of violence by a senior minister of a fairly big state of India. So I explored deeper into this whole thing, and I found that he was oversimplifying the whole issue of violence. And he thought that if the women have something to hit, that is what is going to save them. Now you tell me, if a minister sends out such a message, how far can the Anti-Domestic Violence Act go? It can't go beyond a point. And we realized that this kind of approach to violence, where you oversimplify the whole issue and just use it as a way to popularize your own election campaign, actually ridicules the whole issue. And there are so many such instances happening whereby violence against women, there is a recognition that yes, it is happening, but it is being used now as a vote gainer. It's just got completely trivialized in so many ways. You know, going in a crowd and raising a slogan against violence is one thing. But helping people to understand the impact of violence, we have not done enough. And I think that is where we really need to move our next agenda onto. What is the impact of this violence? What happens to the community? What happens to the woman? What happens to the children? What happens to the husband? We've not gone deep enough. Remember when we were working on HIV, there were so many studies on the economic impact of HIV that really made us take strides with advocacy. But on the issue of violence against women, we do not have enough data on the impact.
And I guess it's hard to have a conversation right now about what's happening in India without acknowledging what's happening with the Muslim population.
It's a very, very difficult scenario. And all that I would like to say at this juncture is that the political support that we need at this juncture to move the agenda forward is dwindling. it is getting diverted into areas which will only accentuate the gender problem.
I keep thinking about that when I read the news stories coming out of the country about the oppression of and marginalization yes. and oppression right. of the Muslim population. I keep thinking, right. yes, and soon we will hear what has happened to the women.
And it will surface not easily. It's going to take time to surface because at this juncture, it's really unfortunate, but I think the whole gender question is completely forgotten with all this kind of violence that is happening and the whole concept of a nation state that is fully Hindu is taking us miles behind where we had reached. So it's just very unfortunate.
It's really heartbreaking. We're living in such a fraught and frightening moment, I think.
All over.
Yeah. It's hard to turn your eye anywhere where there isn't something to be deeply worried about and frightened for. I was speaking to a professor and a leader at Columbia University, and she was saying to me, you know, older women are the most forward-looking people mm-hmm. in our communities, not just in an essentialist way because they have children and grandchildren, but because of those relationships that are so central to life. They're always looking forward to what's going to be handed on to the next generation.
Absolutely.
And I know that you're writing books and you're still deeply involved in the work, and you have your own grandchildren, and I don't think we've had a moment for a generation that has felt so precarious.
You know, Ilana, it's a mixed bag. It's a collage of images that are in my mind as I look at the future and I look at my grandchildren, how they are growing, what is influencing them. And, you know, my grandson, he's 10 plus. What I love is that he seems to love to cook, you know. He's bringing recipes from the net. He goes and stands in the kitchen. He wants to be a chef. And what I love is that he doesn't even question that, you know, this was a role that was given to women. Cooking, by and large, in India is done by women. And he's cooking, he's calling his friends are enjoying it. And I just feel so good, you know, that there is this part of the new generation, some of them who have left behind the gender stereotypes. They were not brought up in a world where stereotypes existed. And there is a small group where this is happening. And I see it in my grandson, and I feel really good about it. At the same time, there are some things that scare me, you know. And one of that is, again, news stories where the kind of bullying and harassment in schools and the safety of young boys and girls in schools is impossible to even visualize, you know. A seven-year-old was dropped by the father to his school, very close to where I live. And half an hour later, his throat had been slit in the bathroom and he had been killed.
Good
now,
Lord.
Yeah. And now when you look at this, as a grandmother, I worry about what happened. Where did we go wrong? There was a lot of backwards and forwards. And finally, they found an 11th class student who had been watching porn the whole night, wanted to come and experiment with this young boy. And this is in a school, which is a big public school. And there are CCTVs. There is the government legislation. They have got all kinds of security guards and this and that. So what worries me is, when all this is happening, where did I go wrong? Why is it that we've left this legacy at this time? And I think one of the major issues has been, at least in India, where I see it a lot, is that sex and sexuality is still a taboo. To talk about sex, to talk about sexuality is so difficult, so difficult. This is one thing that I want to invest my time in with my grandchildren, so that they can, number one, get a more inclusive approach to development by understanding that there is sexual diversity, that they feel free to be able to express their sexuality and to respect other people's sexuality, and not to be forced into a situation where they have to resort to these kinds of acts. Where, because everything is so hidden, where everything is so under the covers, that you either express it in this negative, negative manner, or you get into huge depression. You do not know, Ilana, the numbers of young children who are not able to express. And what elates me now is that last year, Section 377 was abolished. And I think at least from the legislative and the legal point of view, there is an openness that is coming up. And I really want to invest a lot of time talking about sex and sexuality.
I hear that from a lot of older women, that they understand
that. We have
that,
to. We have to. And I think we need to also, as grandmothers, be able to discuss with our grandchildren the concepts of well-being and how it interfaces with vulnerability. You know, it's sounding a bit bookish, but I will expand it a little bit. We have not at all tried in our programs, projects, approaches to unpack well-being. We have not adequately invested in vulnerabilities. For example, when I was with IPPF, we did a very interesting vulnerability analysis of trafficking in India. And what we found was that some of the best administered states had the highest risk of vulnerabilities. Can you imagine? And Gujarat was one of them, where our Prime Minister Modi used to be the chief minister. It's like mopping the floor with the tap on. You don't understand vulnerability. You don't explore vulnerabilities in the area of trafficking. You look only at numbers of women who were trafficked or the numbers of women who were rescued. You're not plugging the vulnerability at all. When I took this whole analysis, which I did with the National Commission of Women, I took it to the Secretary Women and Child. And the first thing he said was, no. We cannot publish this report. The moment we are seen as vulnerable, you don't know how much political impact that will come on this department, on our ministry. What I'm trying to say here, Ilana, is that as grandmothers, we will have to work with our grandchildren to be able to assess their own vulnerabilities and understand what is their own sense of well-being for them to be truly ready to face a very complicated world. Because the government does not want to venture into these areas where there is even the slightest possibility of being seen as ineffective. Vulnerabilities reveal the government's ineffectiveness.
Right. When you talk about vulnerabilities, what do you mean by that?
Okay. I had already mentioned to you the whole issue of multiple deprivations, to be able to understand that looking at one deprivation in isolation will never solve a problem. For example, way back in 1990, a World Bank report had come up for gender and poverty in India. And it had come up with a finding saying that the status of a woman in a household is inversely proportional to her status in society. I'll unpack this for you. So you will have these very rich women who have a great status in society, but when you go deeper into their lives, they are perhaps the most vulnerable in their own homes. The kind of violence in their lives is mind-blowing. And this is documented by the World Bank. The lack of inclusion in financial decision-making is mind-blowing. The force to produce a son, son preference kills them. The moment they have two or three daughters and no son, the husband goes and marries again or throws her out. That is enough justification. She may be the richest person around. So these are the kinds of vulnerabilities that a lot of people from the rich strata are growing up with.
As you yourself get older and are still seized with the work that you do and are still vital and engaged yourself with your grandchildren, what do you think would change or what the benefit would be if there were more of us listening to what grandmothers and older women have to say?
I think it's very important that the lived realities of women who've been in the front line and are now not so much in the front line. It would be, let me give you an example. In my last book that I wrote, I took the news clippings from the last 1 year in various areas which I wanted to discuss. And as I took those news clippings, I realized that to discuss that news clipping, I always had a personal experience from my work life, which I could put there up front and then expand the whole discussion. To illustrate this point, I'll quickly say that in the work on violence against women, where I was talking about this man who was giving, you know, those bats to women at the time of the mass weddings to beat their husbands, I went back to my experience when I had worked in Afghanistan and I was wanting to understand the lives of women in the Afghanistan jails. I had gone with the assumption that women would be really feeling so bad in the jails. I don't know what the conditions would be like. But as I approached the jails, I saw a lot of fun, a lot of merriment, a lot of happiness amongst the women who were jailed. And I sat with them and I chatted. And of course, they all shared their experiences, why they were in jail. And one of them said, you know, my husband had murdered somebody, but he accused me for adultery, saying that I was in love with that man. And so he had to murder him. So he got scot-free and I'm in jail because in Afghanistan, adultery is the worst crime that a woman can commit. Now, what this whole thing showed me was that women are probably, and they themselves said that they are finding that the home is a jail for them and the jail is a place to be liberated. Now, you tell me how many people would benefit from such an experience. And wherever I go and talk about violence in the homes, this Afghanistan example stands out. So the kind of experience that we as grandmothers, who are grandmothers now, have had in our lifetime because we were in the forefront and the learnings we got from the women themselves, it's huge, Ilana, in many ways. Yeah. And also the fact that we were learners at that time. So this kind of learning that we have right from the field at a time when the women's movement was really in its full form, I think we have that advantage. At that moment, there was a lot happening in the women's movement, which is now slowing down because of the political upheavals and the kinds of things that are happening. I think there is a potential to change stereotypes. There's a potential we still have to be able to create dissonance in the minds of people by some of the things that we have seen.
I couldn't agree more. It's beautifully put. I feel very fortunate because I have the benefit of that learning from women like you. So I appreciate it.
We learn from each other and I learn from the women out there. Yes. I'm still learning. It's there that we got all the learnings from.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I hope, Madhu, that we have a chance to speak again because I know we've just scratched the surface. But this was truly wonderful. And I hope that people will find your books and read them. They're as insightful and as thoughtful as you and filled with learnings.
Thank you, Ilana. And I want you to know that your work on human rights at the time when we were in UNIFEM was truly enlightening for me. You were a young woman who felt for the human rights issues and you energized me.
Thank you. That means the world to me coming from you.
No, really, seriously. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We'll be in touch, Ilana.
Bye-bye.
So, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. I'm Ilana Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move. If you want to find out more about me or the podcast, go to grandmothersonthemove.com and come back next week for another episode.